basically, the fall is a reversal of that order. The covenant Lord and the covenant servant saying, no, I'm going to be the covenant Lord and God is going to be my servant. So if God fits into my life plan, if I can figure out how God will help me get ahead in life and get what I'm after and give me self-esteem and so forth, fine. But I'm in the driver's seat here. You're listening to the White Horse Inn, and we're talking about A Time for Truth.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Welcome to the new year. We're kicking off a new series for 2007. We're calling it A Time for Truth. It's been over a decade now since David Wells, a theological statesman of the evangelical movement, wrote his book, No Place for Truth. Not given to overstatement, Wells' first critique of the evangelical movement, in which he has played such an enormous and positive role, made a lot of people shift in their seats. It helped galvanize efforts to provide a common witness, strengthened the hands of faithful laborers in pastoral ministry and on the mission field. But by and large, the movement he critiques goes on as if the book had never been written. About the same time, a book that I edited, Power Religion, The Selling Out of Evangelicalism, carried the same message with contributions from J.I. Packer, Charles Colson, R.C. Sproul, James Boyce, and other evangelical leaders. And again, there were a lot of reviews and a few discussions, but the book didn't appear to radically alter the landscape. And then, a little later, Drs. Boyce, Wells, and I drafted the Cambridge Declaration and put together a meeting in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to discuss these issues. Again, despite the fact that this event was attended by 100 Christian leaders from a variety of denominations, and the writer was thought to be sympathetic to our effort, evangelicalism's leading news periodical described it as an example of tribalism, with a potential for dividing rather than uniting the movement. All of this has reminded me that God has promised to work through his church, not through movements, even big ones like evangelicalism. And there are certainly encouraging signs in those churches. We regularly hear from pastors who've changed their entire approach to ministry, with truth rather than fads and market research as their norm. But when we look at the big picture, things don't look very encouraging. Philip Jenkins' critically acclaimed study titled Next Christendom told us what we already knew. While Christianity's declining in the West, it's exploding in Africa and Asia. However, it's for the most part Pentecostalism, even an extreme version of it known as the prosperity gospel that's sweeping the two-thirds world. Meanwhile, back at home, even churches that are formally committed to the ecumenical creeds and Reformation confessions are losing their confidence in truth to change lives. Once again, we hear tired calls for deeds, not creeds, life, not doctrine. Proclamation increasingly gives way to propaganda, truth to technique, theology to therapy, and covenantal nurture through preaching and sacrament to niche demographics through market segmentation and obsessing over the next new thing. If traditionalists became senile, forgetting the great truths that drive Christian faith and practice, their children, the boomers, became silly, turning church into an eternal youth group, and their children, many of whom are identified by the label emergent, are struggling quite understandably to find something more significant than evangelicalism to belong to. Last year, our focus at the White Horse Inn and modern Reformation was the Romans Revolution, based on Paul's famous letter. This year, we're announcing a new theme. We're calling it A Time for Truth. And this month, we'll be laying out the case for truth in our time. In the coming months, we'll be using the so-called solas as our rubric. What are the solas, or to be precise, sole? Latin for only, sola, became the qualifier that made all the difference in the Reformation. The medieval church believed in Scripture, of course, but the Reformers insisted that Scripture alone was sufficient for determining what we believe, how we worship, and how we live as God's redeemed people in the world. Sola Scriptura, Scripture alone, as the source of Christian faith and life. The medieval church believed in grace, But it was the Reformers' insistence that salvation was by grace alone that provoked the controversy. Sola gratia, grace alone as the way of salvation. No medieval priest or theologian would have denied the necessity of faith for justification. But the Reformation's controversial claim was that we were justified by God through faith alone. Sola fide, justification by grace alone through faith alone. Most importantly, the Reformers emphasized that Christ was not only necessary, but that it is his person and work alone that serves as the basis for our relationship with God. Solo Christo. It's by Christ alone that we find God a forgiving Father rather than a terrifying judge. Since we're saved by God's grace alone, through faith alone, in Christ alone, the only proper response is Soli Deo Gloria. To God alone be glory. The truth of Scripture can't be reduced to a few slogans, of course, but these solas at least point us in the right direction. You know, whenever I lose my keys, which is all too often, I find that I have to retrace my steps. And that's exactly what we're hoping to do in this series. Of course, every era is a time for truth, and there's never been a golden age of church history. Every generation has constantly had to struggle with its own willingness to embrace the offense of the cross and be a place for truth in a world of spin. By the end of 2007, we hope you'll be significantly strengthened in your own faith, knowing what you believe and why you believe it, so that you can become a more vital witness right where you are. It's a time for truth, and to take up this important series, we have our usual cast of characters here. Kim Riddlebarger is the pastor of Christ Reformed Church in Anaheim, California. Rod Rosenblatt teaches theology at Concordia University in Irvine, California, and is a Missouri Synod Lutheran pastor. And Ken Jones is the pastor of Greater Union Baptist Church in Compton, California. I'm Mike Horton, and I teach at Westminster Seminary, California. First of all, gentlemen, it's really exciting to be taking up a new series. We thought long and hard about what we should be focusing on this year. And
Happy New Year to all of you guys.
Happy New Year. Yeah. A time for truth. Every age is a time for truth, of course, but why is this especially a rallying call for us right now?
Well, given the state of the church today, I would think this is a very pressing issue. You just look at the Barna polls and others, the Harris poll that came out late in 06, and you get a sense that Christians are either functioning deists, God created all things, set all things in motion, that Christians look to the subjective, I think, I feel. Christians look to the pragmatic, what works, what will attract the biggest audience. Christians become increasingly uncomfortable about saying what I believe is right, what you believe is wrong. We're up against it with Islam, which is a competing truth claim, not just a different sense of emotions and subjective opinions, but a competing truth claim that oftentimes comes intellectually with the point of the sword. And then we're up against it with the idea that if we are going to talk about Christianity as true, how do we communicate that to people who are offended by the very mention of the fact that something is true? So there are a gazillion issues here, Mike, and this is a great series.
It reminds you of all of the warnings in previous generations to the church about becoming worldly.
Yeah.
It has really come home to roost. Unfortunately, what many people meant by worldly was more of a along the moral or ethical or ethical lines. But really the worldliness that has caused all of the things that you just described, Kim, is a mindset. It's a worldview.
Yep.
Yeah, in fact, Martin Marty, who's not exactly a right-wing conservative Protestant, says, pure religion demands accurate stories. There should be no illusions. We dare not call ourselves one thing and be another. If we wish to follow religious visions, we have to know something about the odds, the distractions, the opposition. Americans are to be most faulted when they find religious justifications for their illusions and their worldly ways, when they're content with false prophets who tell them they're spiritual when they are not.
How nice for the editor of the Christian Century to lecture us.
Yes.
A Missouri Synod Lutheran was, anyway.
Donald Blesch laments, what is conspicuous in American church life in particular is the dissipation of doctrinal and apostolic substance. There's a preoccupation with the cultivation of the inner life and holistic salvation. but faithfulness to the apostolic faith rediscovered and attested anew in the Reformation is dismally lacking.
Wow.
Good for Blush. Yeah. Do any of these fellows, I'm talking about one who used to be a Missouri Lutheran, do any of them see, I wonder, that their earlier work was part of the dissipation of the clarity of the proclamation within the Orthodox Reformation churches? I think the answer is no.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we're seeing, remarkably, is that there are a lot of mainline theologians who are saying, look, we've come to the end of this, and we sort of see where it's going, and evangelicalism is sort of merrily following in that same trajectory. And they're saying, no, turn back. Let's go back to the cisterns that actually have water in them.
Mm. Well, and those quotes you read, Mike, are, if I'm correct, a number of years old now. Those are quotes that are 10 or more years ago. And things have not gotten better. People have not heeded those warnings.
No.
And so this snowball has rolled downhill 10 years plus after those comments and has gotten a lot bigger and picked up a lot of momentum.
You know, I will never forget, it must have been 2 decades ago, an unknown pastor from Switzerland was over talking to all of the youth leaders of America. They came from the eastern, they came from everywhere to San Diego to listen to Francis Schaeffer. And if there's one thing I remember from that conference way back when, he appealed to every youth leader who was there, please, when you present the gospel, present it first of all as true, not as helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that the problem that we're seeing at a very practical level as a result of this loss of a biblical worldview or mindset is, number one, Christians, most evangelicals, are enmeshed in the culture to the point that they're not able to recognize or appreciate propositional truth. Secondly, because of that, we're not able to defend Christianity on propositional terms. So Christianity, we really have bought into the mindset of pluralism and pragmatism, that whatever works for you, and that every religion is of equal value if it's okay for you. And I think that twofold problem, the inability to recognize absolute truth and appreciate it for its absolute value or the fact that it is true, and then secondly, to defend Christianity in propositional terms.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, don't you think, too, part of this is a reaction against a kind of dead, dry conservatism, a mere propositionalism that said, here are the 4 spiritual laws, or here are the 10 propositions that you have to believe, and by the way, you know, try not to ask any questions about it. And now there's a reaction against that kind of absolutism in the direction of saying, you know, I can't say who's right or wrong, but this is the faith commitment I've made.
Well, I wonder, that could play a part, but the first aspect I think about is the universality of the university faculties in the humanities and the constant reiteration of those themes on the television. That is, that we know for sure that there's no truth that's for sure. And if you're in the position of critiquing another one, you're on sand. You're standing on sand, not rock. It can't be done. You know, it's like the Chinese water torture, to switch the metaphor. You do that for long enough, do it in your public schools, do it in your universities, and finally it will trickle down.
And then you do it in your youth groups and, you know.
Sure. And just look at the discourse that takes place, say, in the political arena, which, you know, there'd be some parallels. You get the cable news shows where you get 2 competing positions and all they do is yell at each other.
At the same time.
At the same time. Yeah. And it's all pathos. Who can strike the most responsive chord? Who can be the wittiest? Who can maybe get in the clever soundbite? That's the way in which public discourse on critical issues seems to take place
today.
Well,
Jacques Ellul, the French law professor and Christian commentator, years ago said that when people give up truth, the search for truth, the humble but real search for truth, a truth that lies outside of them, then things turn to propaganda. And he says the difference between the search for truth and propaganda is that propaganda is pursued simply on the basis of emotional power.
Uh-huh. Hmm. Uh-huh.
And boy, that's what we see in evangelism,
Oh, yeah.
In Christian action in politics and morality, boy, a whole host of areas across the evangelical landscape.
I want to go back to something that, Rod had mentioned, as you know, and as Mike, as you were talking about why maybe some evangelicals have lost confidence in propositional truth. I think we saw it, Rod, when you were speaking of the young people that went to listen to Francis Schaeffer. I think part of, especially those that came out of evangelical churches or at least Reformed churches at that time, they were reacting against the hypocrisy against truth. In other words, they were presented with the confessions and the catechisms and so forth. But during that period, especially the late 50s, early 60s, mid 60s, what they saw from those who taught them that propositional truth were things that were inconsistent in terms of social behavior and personal conduct. So they were being taught the Ten Commandments, they were being taught the ecumenical creeds, but what they saw was war, what they saw was racism, what they saw was undercover alcoholism among their parents, what they saw was a lack of love in the churches that they were part of.
And, so it was just talk.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, I don't know if we've ever really gotten over that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the 60s threw some things into the mix that I don't know. I think we're just starting to deal with some of those things at a substantial level.
Yeah, Schaeffer went on to say right after that early point in his ministry where he made the case that, look, what's wrong with evangelicalism is the stress on personal peace and affluency.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that speaks exactly to Ken's issue, that people on the outside had to be Ozzie and Harriet or Father Knows Best, and inside, everything had rotted down to its foundation. Mm-hmm. And so all it took was a little bit of a windstorm to come along, and the whole evangelical edifice would be gone.
Well, look at how often leaders in the evangelical movement, who are noted for their appeal to absolute truth on issues like sexuality, for example, or mm-hmm. other issues, have to step down from their posts because they've been found out to themselves be living a lifestyle that is totally hypocritical.
Yeah. Well, and I'm going to go back even further than that. I think this has been an ongoing issue in American evangelicalism going all the way back to the First Great Awakening. There were periods where the propositional truth that was held by the church corporately was inconsistent with what was practiced by the church corporately. Everything from slavery to other very significant social issues, the church took the right position theologically, but what they practiced was something altogether different. And eventually what we saw in the 60s was an explosion of that sort of hypocrisy.
How much of it, too, is that propositions were unmoored from the grand drama of redemption?
Oh, of course. That's huge.
Yeah, so where you have people who were never introduced to the great story, the plot line.
Yeah. Right.
Preaching in the churches in which I was raised was expositional preaching. And by that, it was verse by verse. And the kind of preaching was to labor through one or two verses. The minister would glory in how long it took him to preach through a book. And so you got very good factual information. I learned a lot of Greek verbs, and I learned what a lot of verses meant. I learned a lot of historical background. Mm-hmm. And my analogy is it would be like someone who's into the tabletop jigsaw puzzles. And preaching in my churches was the analysis of each of the puzzle pieces until we looked at every individual piece of that puzzle. We never once put the puzzle together and looked at the box top.
And that's Jesus said himself that when you do that, you look at the box top, the image that emerges is He.
Exactly.
Christ is the one who is the puzzle.
Yeah, there is this grand meta-narrative, and it's what God's doing in Christ to reconcile sinners unto himself that begins in Genesis and concludes in Revelation. But we knew lots of Bible,
yes,
but not the whole story.
Yes. I think that we have to also see in this situation with the degeneration of the evangelicals' use of propositional truth or confidence in it, or that unity trumps every ace. If you want to teach something, the first question is, will it disunite? In that world, the radicalness of schooling kids well in all subjects, but including the knowledge of the message of the scriptures and doing it well, would be so powerful that atheists would ask to be in those, have their kids in those schools. And if you told them, we'll have chapel, they'd answer, I don't care.
Yeah. Just want them to learn something.
Exactly.
Yes. I mean, yeah. Really, it's a Kairos mm-hmm. time mm-hmm. when everything's unraveling for the Reformation people mm-hmm. to represent not just good theology, but also be doing other things well when there's a vacuum of it in the culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
You mentioned Francis Schaeffer several times in his approach. Schaeffer himself reported what happened with Labrie, the center that he established in Switzerland, where students came from all over the world to hang out there in a French chalet and
many times rebuild their evangelical faith that had failed.
Exactly. People came as agnostics.
David Wells among them.
What, really?
Was he one?
Yeah.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. Oz Guinness, another.
Yeah. Huh.
He says, students from the London School of Economics, Harvard, and the Sorbonne, from Africa and Asia, and from the ends of the earth, have come to Labrie with their backpacks on their backs. But if you think they would listen to us if we were not willing to say what Christianity teaches, that is, what God has spoken, stands as an antithesis to its opposite, you don't understand your own children and your own age. Mm. Our credibility is already -5 if we don't say what is false and wrong in contrast to what is true and right. Some Christians think they'll be listened to more if they give in a little bit at some points concerning the Scripture. But they are mistaken. They have given away the answers which are needed desperately.
Uh-huh. God bless that guy.
Yeah, I mean, that has been proven true in my own experience talking to people who are a little bit younger than I am. There is, unlike the boomer who just is concerned with personal peace and affluence, their kids really are saying, I've got 5 minutes. And I'm ready to pull the plug on religion.
Yes.
Yeah.
I want to hear, I know you can't prove beyond any doubt what it is that is true about Christianity, but I want you to give me something cognitive. I want to understand the claims of Christianity and whether this thing is worth pursuing. Mm-hmm. If it's not true, I don't want to do it because there's a Starbucks in the lobby at church. I don't want to do it because it's a place to go and meet friends. I don't want to do it because I get my religious thrills out of raising my hands and singing praise choruses.
No, I think you hit it right on the head. The generation after the boomers, and we see it in various cultural forms and expressions, they are looking for something substantive. They're looking for something meaningful, the way Adam Duritz of Counting Crows put it. We all want something meaningful. And they are looking for something meaningful, and they're turning to the church, expecting the church to provide substance. And I think their greatest disappointment, if the baby boomers were disappointed at the church because of its hypocrisy, this generation is disappointed at the church because of its superficiality.
Well, the statistics bear that out. What was David Murrow's number for the amount of males who are no longer attending church at 19?
Mm, yeah.
It's huge. Yeah. The vast majority are no longer in church. And Ken, I think that's exactly the issue. You nailed it.
This was an article, a fairly recent article in Time magazine, In Touch with Jesus. Sugar-coated MTV-style youth ministry is so over. Bible-based worship is packing teens in pews now.
Yeah,
that's Time magazine.
That's by the way, from a church in Bellflower, which is right over here in Southern California, in the heart of a Dutch Reformed enclave. And I'm going to get in trouble, but I'm going to say it anyway. A lot of those Dutch Reformed churches, their youth groups, have become the extreme this and
late.
Late, and it's all the pizza and everything else, but going through the Scriptures and the Catechism. Meanwhile. Yeah. The independent Bible church next door said, enough of that. They're going back to Bible-based teaching and instruction, and their church is packed out.
It's just remarkable.
It's just remarkable.
Well, that's what sparked part of the growth of the Calvary Chapel.
Yeah,
Calvary Chapel centered on what they felt was faithful teaching of the Scriptures.
Uh-huh. The Bible was open, and it was being proclaimed.
This Time magazine article goes on to say, youth ministers have been on a long and frustrated quest of their own over the past 2 decades or so. Believing that a message wrapped in pop culture packaging was the way to attract teens to their flocks, pastors watered down the religious content and boosted the entertainment. But in recent years, churches have begun offering their young people a style of religious instruction grounded in Bible study and teachings about the doctrines of their denomination. Hmm. Their conversion has been sparked by the recognition that sugar-coated Christianity, popular in the 1980s and early 90s, has caused growing numbers of kids to turn away not just from attending youth fellowship activities, but also from practicing their faith at all. In a national survey recently released by the Barna Group, a polling firm that tracks religious trends, only 33% of kids, 33% of kids, 13 to 18, responded that they attend a youth group event regularly. And while nearly 75% pray each week, that number has declined 9%. Even more worrisome to many youth ministers was the survey finding that 61% of the adults polled, who are now in their 20s, said they had participated in church activities as teens but do so no longer.
Wow.
Wow. Well, let's learn a lesson from the mainline Protestant denominations in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. They managed to numerically halve themselves by preaching social gospel, by preaching against the war in Vietnam and all the rest of that, and not preaching Christ or the doctrine of their church. So it shouldn't come as a surprise when evangelical and reformed churches that are confessional on paper do exactly the same thing that people leave. Why go to church if the faith that's proclaimed there isn't true? Why even go? And so
or even interesting. Forget the question of truth for a moment. It doesn't say anything that is different from what you can find on Dr. Phil or Dr. Laura or
you mentioned the Starbucks at the church and the attractions at the church that draw young people. Hey, they can get that stuff at the mall. And if they want to hang out with their friends, the cooler kids are at the mall anyway, or wherever else is it kids go today. Or they're on their cell phone, engaged in some cyber conversation with their buds elsewhere. I mean, the church loses every time we try and be relevant like that. We're just shooting ourselves in the foot.
And while the children are there, and this is, I think, the false assumption, is because they're able to pack the children in or the youth in while they're underage, and assuming that their presence means they enjoy these things or it's beneficial to them when they get older. And they're only doing it, by the way, to be polite because they've been taught to respect their parents and so forth. And they do have an implicit trust in the church. But when they become of age, they really become resentful. And even if they don't leave, and you know, we're looking at the figures that say they don't remain. But even if they remain, what I'm concerned about is we are producing a brand of Christian that really has little confidence in the truth content of the faith that they represent.
Yeah. Let's go to the heart of the question for this program. We're going to be looking at this whole question of truth, first of all, from the perspective of denying the truth, outright explicit denial of the truth, and then we'll look at distortions of the truth, and then finally, distractions from the truth that we often find in the church today. But first of all, denying the truth, which is something that you don't often find explicit in at least evangelical churches, an outright denial of the truth, but you certainly do in the wider culture. Playing God has been the direction of the human heart ever since the fall. What was the original relationship between humanity and the truth in creation?
Man is created in the divine image, and what that means is that man is created in such a way to continually and naturally receive the revelation that God continuously gives through natural order. Paul's very clear that we are made in such a way to receive the revelation that God gives so that the truth of God, as Paul writes in Romans 1, is manifest in us. That means we see that there is a God. We understand that there is a God. We know that he has divine attributes, that he's all-powerful, and that he's going to be the supreme judge. We're made so that revelation gets through. But because of human sin, Paul goes on to say, that natural revelation that's given through the created order is inevitably suppressed in unrighteousness. People don't like what they know about God from the natural order. Because of their sin, it's the basic premise, we will not have this man rule over us. And so they exchange the truth of God for a lie. And whenever they exchange the truth, they end up worshiping the created things, the created order, not the God who created the order. So you get a sun god, you get a moon god, you get
the Porsche God,
you know,
all of those things, instead of the one who created the sun, the moon, the stars, and who created the engineers in Germany who could give us Porsches.
So you actually become irrational when you give up belief in God.
Yeah, and the interesting thing, the order that you set there, is that because man is created where he can recognize and respond to revealed truth, so the morality, the original righteousness or obedience of Adam before the fall was a result of his knowledge of truth, not the other way around.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And so it's basically the fall is a reversal of that order.
Sure.
The covenant Lord and the covenant servant. It's reversing that order and saying, no, I'm going to be the covenant Lord and God is going to be my servant. So if God fits into my life plan, if I can figure out how God will help me get ahead in life and get what I'm after and make me give me self-esteem and so forth, fine. But I'm in the driver's seat here.
Yeah, it's very much like the title of a book of essays by Lewis, God in the Dock. Mm. We are the judge. Mm-hmm. He's in the witness stand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To defend himself.
Yeah, you think of the book of Job where God says, okay, I've had to endure this trial now for a long time, and all of the theologians sitting around debating things, and now if it's okay, I'm going
to
speak. I've got something to say. Where were you when I created everything and so forth?
But again, that's why it's important when you go back to Paul's words in Romans 1. His point is it's not that we don't have access to truth, but because of our immorality, because of our unrighteousness, we have sought to suppress the truth.
Right. Yeah. The Greek verb is like standing on a cigarette butt. To press down the truth and unrighteousness. The other thing that I think is important here, Romans is a logical outlaying of the content of the Christian faith. And the context of those verses in Romans 1, Paul is pre-guessing his opponent out of paganism. And he's imagining, probably rightly so, the Gentiles are going to argue, jump on the Jews, they had the oracles, we never did. We never heard of Moses.
Mm-hmm. Can't blame us.
Can't blame us.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But the other guys had the book, and those you could rightly judge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whereas the Jews, on the other hand, were saying, judge those Gentiles because
of their immorality.
Their immorality. Yeah. And so Paul says, I'm going to do something to both of you you're not going to like.
Yes.
Well, again, Francis Schaeffer speaks to this issue, I think, very profoundly. He makes the point that non-Christians try to make their own world and then live in it. Hmm. And the problem is they don't live in the world they made.
They can't.
They can't. They live in the world God made. And so they continue to bump into reality. It's like the guy who goes to a Radio Shack and buys the electronic kit to build a radio or some electronic device and throws the instructions away and says, I'll just pray about it and put it together as I see fit. Well, he catches his house on fire doing that. The fact of the matter is the real world is as God has made, and you're going to run into it if you don't think God's thoughts after him. Mm-hmm. And so there's always an irrationality. There's always an inability to explain the world as it is if you reject the truth of God for the lie. You can't explain the world as it is because God made it and he explains it.
So Paul is basically saying here, look, you already know the truth. Yeah, you already know that God exists.
At least by eternal godness and power.
Right.
Yeah. At least that.
You know the law. You know that God is a judge. You know that God is glorious. You know that God is the creator. You know all of that. And you suppress that at the end of the day, not because you don't have enough arguments. Uh-huh. You suppress that at the end of the day because you don't like the conclusion.
Yeah, and as Paul goes on to say, therefore they are without excuse.
Yeah, because the extension of knowing is a corresponding behavior. There is an oughtness in our behavior. But because our behavior is inconsistent with what we know, we'd rather lean in the direction of what we do and we suppress what we know.
Yep. One of the great illustrations that Cornelius Van Til used was of a fish that had a whole ocean to swim in. All this creaturely freedom.
He complains.
And he complains as he's swimming back and forth. He can't possibly swim in all of that ocean that
he has.
We'll
never get to all of the water.
Never get to all the water. And he looks out at the sand, though, one day, and he sees this couple walking along the sand. And he says, I want to walk on the sand. I'm tired of the water. And so he leaps onto the sand and flops around, and you know what happens? He's there, finally ready for the cats.
Well, no, Darwin said he eventually became that couple on the beach, right?
That's right, because he really, really, really wanted to. Yeah. But that's the point. We have we were created with all of this freedom, but we didn't want creaturely freedom. We wanted the kind of freedom God has.
But
we wanted to be gods.
The 3 points that you laid out in opening this discussion is exactly what we find in the garden. You have denial of what God has said. You have a distortion of what God has said, and then you have a distraction of what else God has revealed. And that threefold pattern has followed us consistently. You talk about a fish who's in an ocean where he'll never see all of the water that he has access to. Adam and Eve had access to every tree
in the garden, save one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they thought they were being cheated because God's truth had been denied, distorted, and therefore their confidence in God had been distracted.
Paul says that in the last days, people will be lovers of themselves, boastful, proud, arrogant, abusive, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, following after teachers who will tell them what their itching ears want to hear.
And they all have a television program, by the way. You did know that.
Exactly.
On cable.
I didn't know that was in the text.
Oh, well, it's in the New International Revised.
I see.
If you look in the notes, it's in some of the manuscripts.
I see.
Is this descriptive of our time and place? How do we play God with truth today?
Hmm. Well, it's absolutely descriptive of the entire period of time between Christ's first and second coming. I think Paul is laying out the course of the age is after the coming of Christ, believers are going to be preoccupied by all of those things mentioned because Christ comes and he says, my righteousness will save you. My cross will save you. You cannot save yourself. And so the distraction ultimately is toward self-salvation. Mm-hmm. And if we can't deny that outright, we will busy ourselves with things to make that kind of move to the recesses of the mind so we're not constantly thinking about it.
Another aspect of it, in our culture that we've been looking at for the decade or a little more, if anything describes it, it's entertainment.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And
that's Neil Gabler's point, and
you know,
it's spot on.
If God doesn't come to me in entertainment mode, I'm not going to entertain thoughts of him.
Mm. That's a great point.
To paraphrase the Lord, when the Son of Man returns, will he find a thought on the earth?
Mm. Right, right.
Well, and Kim, you mentioned the inner Advental period. That is exactly what you see in the book of Revelation. That is the challenge. Throughout the period of time between Christ's first and second coming, the challenge is from world systems and
governments.
From various false religions, you have a challenge to truth.
Yep. And you've got the city of man, Babylon, with all its glitz and all its glamour and all its celebrity.
The whole entertainment thing,
committing fornication with the kings of the earth, the whole entertainment thing is Babylon the Great.
Yeah. Recently, someone introduced me to an intro book in philosophy published by Oxford University Press, and it's by a fellow who's a very respected epistemologist, Nagel. And in that short little book, there was a paragraph that I thought was one of the most honest things I'd ever seen a philosopher write. He said, I will always use arguments against Christianity, even bad ones. And then he tells us why. He said, the very thought that I have to answer for my life to anybody is so repugnant and so obnoxious to me that I will even bring bad arguments to bear against it.
I
thought, God bless you for saying it.
Yeah, just being honest like that.
But that's exactly it.
Well, Friedrich Nietzsche,
it our way.
The end of the 19th century made that very point. He said, at the end of the day, truth is made rather than discovered. It has to be that way. Basically, he says, otherwise, I'm not in charge. I'm not the one who's in the driver's seat of my own existence. But the point that we're making so far is that we can't think in a way that is inconsistent with reality.
Hmm. Not for very long.
If reality is a certain way, then you can't just decide how you're going to come into contact with it.
Yeah.
The way reality is going to have to determine how you come into contact with it. So you think of C.S. Lewis's argument, if God doesn't exist and everything emerged from the chaos by happenstance, then all reason and argumentation is founded upon illogical chaos rather than reason and rationality. So if reality is the product of a rational process, not just reason, but also affection, you know, love.
Intuition.
God did it out of love.
Yeah.
If it isn't the result of a personal God's taking personal interest in something other than himself and establishing it in a rational way, then there is absolutely no foundation for or source for the conviction that we can know anything, even in a probabilistic way, at all.
Yeah, the constant problem for the materialist, and he's the one Lewis had in mind, the constant problem for the materialist is that he reduces thought to brain chemistry. Mm-hmm. But then when you defend that thesis, you've lost the limb on which you sat before. Lewis called it the mental proof. And that's what he was saying. If all is brain physiology, JJC Smart, if there is no mind, just brain, then you couldn't defend the thesis anyway, and you can't have an argument because it all collapses into electrons and physics, finally.
But that's okay if you saw your limb off. It's okay as long as you have already soothed yourself into thinking that there is no God with whom you have to deal.
Yeah, I was sitting on a 767 next to a guy reading Nietzsche and made the point, you know, if you live in Nietzsche's world, why are you on this airplane?
Right. Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of physics involved in this huge thing getting off the ground, and those two Rolls-Royce turbo engines driving this thing, you know, 35,000 feet at 525 miles per hour. And then you tell me there are no absolutes and it's the will to power only?
It's a good point. I wanted to say something to what you said, Ken, earlier. When we say the overalls of what we're reading in Romans 1 and what it says to us and us post-fall creatures, men and women, we aren't saying that the individual Reformation believer should accuse individuals every time of basically not asking honest questions but trying to defend their own immorality.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know that. Sometimes honest doubters' questions are what they look like, and we've got to honor that.
No doubt. But I would say that as Christians, as evangelicals, I think we have argued from the wrong direction. We have looked at ethics and morality and then have lost sight of the absolute truth.
Yes.
The most frightening scenario is not a world where there is no morality, but a world where there is no truth.
Uh-huh.
Ultimately, that's it. One will lead to the other. But ultimately, our concern is the loss of truth. And I think
if you don't have truth, you don't have morality.
Yeah, absolutely.
And boy, is that a powerful point. I mean, when I was teaching at Westmont, students were more concerned with the question of truth. And when I went to a college of my own denomination, all the discussions amongst the students were ethics. And it made me wonder what was going on in the congregations, that everything had centered on ethics.
And having a 16-year-old and a 19-year-old in my home and being around young men and hearing them describe their culture, they're not even talking about ethics anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
It's entertainment, as you say.
Yes.
Don't you think, too, one place where we can begin with a lot of younger folks who say, look, I don't want to talk about truth. I don't want to talk about propositions and assertions and so forth, and my truth is right, your truth is wrong. I don't want to start there. Can't we start with them by saying, you believe in meaning. You're looking for something meaningful. That's something that your generation is all about. For myself, I can at least say, there is no meaning. There's only boredom if I am the creator of truth, because I have my own CD collection, and I don't know which CD to play. And I have my own favorite pastimes, and I have meaning is someone or something outside of me surprising me with something new, knocking me off my horse and exposing me to a piece of reality that is so much more interesting than the boring same old that I've been experiencing. If you don't believe that truth exists outside of you, then you cannot have that kind of exposure to the possibility of a new
encounter.
I don't know.
Curiosity is in principle trumped.
But I don't know if the fallen mind is capable of seeing how boring they are individually,
well,
especially when we are being told by so many sources outside of us that it's in you. I don't know. I think it's a conundrum.
Thinkers talk about the hedonistic paradox, and I think they're right.
Yeah.
That is, if it's the next thrill, you better dedicate yourself deeply because it's going to bore you in a shorter time than the last thrill.
Oh, I think we have proof positive that that is indeed the case. I don't know if the struggle that's taking place within the culture and within the mind of the unbeliever is that they will ultimately see that the problem is them trying to define their own reality.
Rod, you made a brilliant point a while back when we were discussing this, and I don't remember the exact context, but the issue was the entertainment mindset, the need for constant new experiences and so on. And you made the point that works until a nuke goes off in Minneapolis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you know, no one wants calamity to come.
Yep.
But a calamity, a national disaster, a national emergency, economic blight, something like that will just bring this culture and the evangelical church to its knees immediately.
Yeah.
And that point, there's this gigantic vacuum. But until that happens,
Was it Sam Solomon who said there's only one form of Christianity in America that's capable of withstanding Islam, and that's the Reformation?
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't want to even think in those terms. Nobody wants to think of something horrible happening. But all of the talk of entertainment will go immediately.
Yeah.
And then in a Nietzschean world, it's who's got the most guns.
Yep.
And
but
that's
but we're going to fall to another idol. Again,
sure,
you know, the
sure.
fallen mind is capable
sure.
of new idols every day.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
when one is proven to be invalid and too boring, then we'll come up with another
right,
one.
Exactly.
Right. We are very adept at that.
Yeah.
We will look to the state for protection. We'll make the state or its leader. The
or we'll
yes.
turn inward to the individual.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, we have all, we're infinitely resourceful
yeah,
in
yeah.
idolatry.
And we just continue a cycle. There, I mean, obviously we will run out of idols, but we will just return back to the one from previous generations.
But that creates a huge opportunity for the preaching of the gospel.
Oh,
yeah.
I think so.
And it was Tolkien. Mm-hmm. It was Tolkien who pressed Lewis on this. Tolkien, the Chestertonian style of Roman Catholic. He pressed Lewis. It's one thing to establish theism. But Tolkien saw, and he pressed it with Lewis, that liar, lunatic, legend, or lord mm-hmm. argument to Lewis, as well he should have. We can't relax in deism either.
Right.
That is not the end of the road. It's the beginning of the trek that leads to a cross.
Mm-hmm.
And by George, you're going to say, yes, he was who he said he was,
yeah.
or
mm-hmm.
no, he wasn't who he said he was. One way or t'other. There's
yeah.
where the thing has to go.
Yeah. You know, and didn't Augustine yeah. deal with this in the City of God? You know, let the City of Man go through its ups and its downs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and doesn't this underscore again that because all things were created by and through and in Jesus Christ,
uh-huh.
He is the truth, not only of our redemption, but of our creation. We're not even talking about redemption yet. We're talking really about truth in the sense of our created existence, our, by definition, covenant creatures. Christ is at the heart of that too. So he is the truth. And at the end of the day, it's impossible for us to, as Christians, sort of cordon off an area where he's true for me.
Right, yeah.
But he isn't.
Yeah,
he isn't the truth of reality, and that's the point
that
we're making here, isn't it?
Yeah.
He is the center of truth, not just for me and my personal relationship with God,
yeah.
but for everything.
I think that is part of our prophetic role in this world, to establish the reality and the absolute truth that is in Christ.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the important distinctions that our classic old theologians made here was between archetypal and ectypal knowledge. That God has a creator kind of knowledge of everything. We have a creature kind of knowledge of everything. And that God and human beings do not at any point intersect either in their being or in their knowledge. They may, the object of their knowledge may be the same thing, But God knows things in a qualitatively, not just quantitatively different way. The creator-creature distinction being firmly maintained there, Lutheran and Reformed, across the board.
Yeah, the way our confessions say, all the children who are conceived in the normal way, to make sure that there is possibility of an incarnation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But our phrase was, everyone conceived in the normal way, ...
Yeah. And isn't this important when people say, on one hand, in order to defend a doctrine of truth, before we can talk about Christianity, we have to defend the very notion of truth. And I dispute that. I think we defend the notion of truth as we defend Christianity. Mm-hmm. But anyway, some will say we've got to defend a notion of truth with a capital T. And then others, the more postmodernists among us, will say, no, we don't have access to that. Don't we have a unique position at this time and place as Reformation Christians to step in and say, look, rationalism and irrationalism are both wrong. We believe that we do have truth with a lowercase t because there is truth with a capital T somewhere. It's just not in us.
Yeah, let me throw a wild card
in. And God revealed it.
Yeah.
Like I said, I think this is part of our prophetic role in this world, and that is to defend and define the truth, the absolute truth, and to recognize the place of truth in this world. And I think the church has failed not only propositionally, but just in an absolute sense. I think one of the reasons we failed to defend absolute truth with a capital T is because we've had so little regard for truth and a small t in living.
We've got to be willing to be creatures again, to be dependent, to be contingent creatures. And when we do that, then we can have confidence in truth with a small t. Because we know that God, who has truth with a capital T, has revealed it to us, and he's faithful. He's reliable. Well, folks, the apostle was convinced that there is a truth outside of us. God has revealed his existence and his invisible attributes in creation. But in our pride, we twist and distort the truth to suit our own sinful behavior. If we acknowledge that truth lies outside of us, then we're no longer in control of where that truth leads us. We would be drawn inexorably to confess the existence of the God who is our judge. Since all truth is ultimately from God and leads to God, our age has decided that it will deny the very notion of reason itself in order to escape this inevitable crisis with its God. Is truth made or discovered? Well, here in this program, we've tried to explore the ways in which Scripture tells us that it is neither made nor discovered, but revealed. God has made it known by the things that he has created. Well, look forward to being with you again next time on The White Horse Inn.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.